This episode features discussion of kidnapping that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
Che Eun-hee knew something was wrong. She stood on a beach just outside of Hong Kong, staring at a white speedboat that was meant to ferry her to a wealthy investor's home.
The 51-year-old South Korean movie star had lived through the Japanese occupation of Korea, World War II, and the Korean War. She'd been in enough bad situations to know when to trust her gut.
And in mid-January 1978, her insides were screaming.
Muscular men stood around the boat, eyes trained on Che Eun-hee. They seemed to recognize her. It sent a shiver down her spine.
Suddenly, the men leaped out of the boat and grabbed her. Before Che Eun-hee knew what was happening, they were speeding off across the water.
Che Eun-hee's blood ran cold. She demanded to know where they were taking her.
The man replied, "Madam Che, we are going to the bosom of the great leader, Comrade General Kim Il-sung."
Che thought she might be sick. She had just been taken hostage by the most ruthless dictator in the world and was on her way to North Korea. This is Hostage, a Parcast original. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we are doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of the South Korean actress Che Eun-hee and her ex-husband, South Korean film director Shin Song-ok, by North Korean dictator-to-be Kim Jong-il in 1978.
Che Eun-hee, or Madam Che as she was often called, disappeared from Hong Kong on January 14, 1978, after having been lured to the city under false pretenses. 6 months later, in July 1978, her ex-husband went looking for her and was similarly abducted.
But it would be another 5 years before either would come face to face again. 5 years of prison, torture, and brainwashing. Once reunited, the two would spend another 3 years in North Korea, awaiting the perfect moment to attempt to escape.
This week, we'll look at the two abductions, the celebrity couple's tumultuous relationship, and the complicated political dynamics that set the stage for their kidnappings. Though North Korea is famously opaque, we'll do our best to understand the situation in the so-called Hermit Kingdom that led to their abduction.
Next week, we'll dig into Che and Shin's experiences in North Korea and the psychology of how they spent 8 years as hostages in an Orwellian dictatorship. We'll also take a look at their North Korean filmmaking career and how they used it to attempt a daring escape fit for a spy thriller.
By 1978, the Korean Peninsula had been divided into two countries since the end of World War II, over 30 years prior. One half was the Soviet and Chinese-backed North, and the other half was the American and UN-backed South.
With the end of World War II came the end of Japan's 35-year occupation of the Korean Peninsula. But instead of getting their country back, the Koreans found themselves arbitrarily divided along the 38th parallel, the circle of latitude that's 38 degrees north of the equator. Both the Soviet Union and the U.S. wanted influence over the newly liberated country, so they decided that each country would take part of Korea.
As with most post-colonial partitions, the division of Korea made no sense. The straight line cut through communities, disrupted regular movement, and certainly had no bearing on whether the inhabitants preferred Marxist communism or democratic capitalism.
In 1948, the now democratic South held its first elections, supervised by the United Nations. Meanwhile, in the North, the Soviets installed a charismatic Red Army officer named Kim Il-sung. Sung was a staunch military man who'd spent much of his adult life in the Soviet Union fighting the Japanese.
Neither the Soviets nor Kim Il-sung were content with just half the peninsula. They decided that their newly formed Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or the DPRK, required the reunification of the Korean Peninsula.
And so, in June 1950, Kim Il-sung and North Korean troops invaded the South with support and aid from the Soviet Union.
Over the next few years, UN coalition forces faced off against the North Korean and Soviet troops, each alternately pushing the other back across the peninsula, decimating the lives and livelihoods of the Korean people. By the time the armistice was signed on July 27, 1953, just under 5 million people had died.
But even then, the war wasn't technically over. The border became known as the Demilitarized Zone, or the DMZ, where both sides kept eyes and guns trained on each other round the clock. In the years to come, the North Korean military would dig miles-long tunnels into South Korea in preparation for an invasion. They would also attempt to assassinate South Korean officials on a somewhat regular basis, as they gave speeches, boarded planes, and attended public events. North Korea used undercover operatives to try to foment revolution against the South Korean government. Most horrifically, they kidnapped thousands of South Koreans in an attempt to reunify the country.
South Korean fishermen had to be especially careful, as the North Koreans were known to commandeer boats that accidentally ventured too far north. The confused fishermen would then be given heroes' welcomes, as if they were long-lost relatives come home from war, before ending up in re-education and work camps for the rest of their lives.
Part of the reason for the ongoing hostilities was to do with internal politics. Kim Il-sung was rapidly consolidating his power, becoming less of a Marxist leader and more of an authoritarian dictator. He built a fantastical origin myth of himself as a godlike military hero who'd liberated his people from their Japanese and Western oppressors. An ongoing war with South Korea only bolstered this narrative.
Meanwhile, as Kim Il-sung consolidated his power, eliminated rivals, and turned the Socialist Republic into a totalitarian police state, his oldest son was watching movies.
Kim Jong-il and his father never really understood each other. The oldest son in the Kim family, Jong-il wasn't a soldier, and he lacked his father's natural leadership, charisma, and physical stature.
He was raised isolated from the other children. His mother and brother died when he was young, so he was raised by hired help, spoiled and pampered. But despite his servants' best efforts, Jong-il quickly became self-conscious about his appearance, and once even joked that he looked like a midget's turd.
His escape was through the movies he was allowed to watch, which his mother had introduced him to. After devouring the few North Korean films available, he started watching films from other communist countries. As he got older, he wanted to see more. So he went behind his father's back to set up his own black market for bootleg movies from around the world. While the rest of North Korea, including Kim Il-sung, had blocked out the outside world, Kim Jong-il devoured every movie he could find in his own private screening rooms. Kim Jong-il liked what he saw in the cinema of the 1960s. Some of his favorite movies were the early James Bond films. He would later imply to Shin Song-ok that he believed they were based on true events, that car chases through France were a common occurrence.
He certainly took inspiration from James Bond. As a student at Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung University, Jong-il developed a reputation as a bit of a playboy. He was especially stylish and interested in international luxury products like whiskey and fast cars, like the Aston Martin DB5 in Goldfinger.
In 1967, 20 years into Kim Il-sung's rule, Il-sung made a sweeping purge of the political elite to further consolidate power and to send a powerful message to any that might oppose him. After the purge, he gave the 26-year-old Kim Jong-il the chance he'd been waiting for, to run North Korea's cultural and propaganda department, and through it, the country's sole movie studio.
At first, Kim Jong-il used his newfound power to prove his loyalty to his father. He produced feature films deifying the supreme leader, enriching and embellishing the narrative that Kim Il-sung had been promoting for years through books, plays, and artwork. This work proved to Kim Il-sung that his oldest son was also the right choice to be his successor.
Simultaneously, Kim Jong-il worked behind the scenes to sabotage and imprison any other possible rivals. His uncle, who'd helped raise Kim Jong-il and had long been seen as Kim Il-sung's right-hand man, suddenly found his advisors imprisoned for disloyalty and so-called factionalism, before himself being put under house arrest. And Jong-il's younger brother, Pyong-il, found himself accused of trying to supplant his father, resulting in his own exile. Before long, Kim Jong-il was practically running the country.
Meanwhile, in the South, things were starting to look up. In May 1961, a military coup had overthrown an elected government that had become increasingly corrupt. The new leader, a general named Park Chung-hee, kept his promise and held the corrupt officials accountable, instituting a new constitution and holding elections in 1963. President Park then funneled resources into cultural institutions, innovation, and infrastructure.
But as the 1960s wore on and the North continued to try to destabilize them with assassination attempts, military raids along the coasts, and infiltration of left-wing activist groups, the South Korean government became increasingly paranoid about spies and saboteurs. After several attempts by North Korea to assassinate President Park, the government declared martial law in 1972, cracking down on protests and activism, implementing censorship laws, and empowering the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, or the KCIA.
It didn't take long for the government's paranoia to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. The South Koreans were soon as mistrustful of their own government as they were of the menace to the North.
Against this tumultuous backdrop, actress Choi Eun-hee and director Shin Song-ok fell in love.
In a moment, a love story fit for the silver screen.
Now back to the story.
Born in 1926 to a poor conservative family in the southern provinces of the Korean Peninsula, Choi Eun-hee ran away from home in 1942 at age 17 in order to be an actress. Her determination kept her going. By 1946, she had a stage career, and she appeared in her first movie at age 21.
She married the cameraman from that first movie, a respected veteran of the South Korean film industry who was 20 years her senior. But the marriage was not a happy one. Jealous of her rising stardom, her husband beat her. He expected her to be a traditional wife while still maintaining her starlet status.
Then, in 1950, when the North Koreans invaded Seoul, Choi Eun-hee was captured and forced to become an entertainer for the North Korean troops. She eventually managed to escape to South Korean territory, but was then forced to become an entertainer for their troops as well.
According to the research of writer and filmmaker Paul Fisher, at least one South Korean officer assaulted the young actress. Between the assaults and the traditional Korean attitude of actresses as virtual courtesans, Choi Eun-hee had developed a reputation for promiscuity by the end of the war.
As a result, her marriage continued to deteriorate. Her husband regularly beat her and raped her. Even as she continued to build her acting career and support them both financially,
the stress soon became unbearable. She grew exhausted and pale. She stopped eating. And then, one evening in 1953, she collapsed during a performance of a play. When Che came to, a handsome young man was carrying her to the hospital.
After she was diagnosed with exhaustion and malnourishment, the young man introduced himself as Shin Song-ok. He was an ambitious young film director who'd come to the performance that night in order to scout her for his next film. He hadn't expected to fall for her immediately, and she for him.
Also born in 1926, Shin Song-ok came from a well-off family that supported his artistic interests. He grew up in a town just north of what would become the South Korean border.
After the war, his family settled in Seoul, South Korea, unable to return home to their village, which was now in North Korea. There, Shin discovered filmmaking through his work in government propaganda offices and made his first feature film using resources taken from those offices.
Emboldened by the critical acclaim of his first film, The Evil Knight, Shin Song-ok planned his next feature. He wanted to make a film that would showcase the natural beauty of Korea and help change the world's image of a war-torn country.
But to do that, he needed a beautiful and talented leading lady, which is how he ended up at Che Eun-hee's performance on that night in 1953.
Handsome and ambitious, fresh off his first feature film, and ready to reinvent the South Korean film industry, Shin Song-ok caught Che Eun-hee's attention immediately. He reminded her of who she'd been before the war, before her abusive marriage. Not only did they fall in love, they became partners, set on revolutionizing the Korean film industry together.
There was just one problem. Che Eun-hee was still married. And when her husband discovered the affair, he leaked it to the press. The pair's fan base went wild.
Somewhat unexpectedly, it was Shin's career that took an initial hit. The Korean film establishment shunned him, treating him as a young upstart with no respect for the industry or tradition. It was a role he would come to relish.
Che Eun-hee, on the other hand, was done with her marriage and used her public profile to successfully sue for divorce, a hard thing for Korean women to do at that time.
By the middle of 1954, Shin Song-ok and Che Eun-hee were officially together, and they set to work making the movies they dreamed of, reshaping the South Korean film industry in the process.
They spent the next two decades making film after film. Their movies told the stories of ordinary Korean people and showcased the beautiful countryside, raising both their own profiles and South Korea's in the process.
Their films broke box office records time and again, brought new technologies and innovations to the Korean film industry, and won international acclaim.
As South Korea's economy picked up in the early 1960s, their studio, Shin Film, brought money and jobs to Seoul, exported a new vision of Korea to the world, and built relationships through international co-productions. Che Eun-hee founded an acting school where she trained the next generation of South Korean performers. Shin Song-ok became famous as an auteur, while Che Eun-hee was one of the era's most famous movie stars, hobnobbing with world leaders and celebrities.
The only thing missing from their lives, as far as Che Eun-hee was concerned, was children. In trying to get pregnant, she discovered that she was unable to. The realization hit her hard, both because of cultural expectations and her own desire to be a mother. Shin Song-ok didn't mind. His movies were his children, and he was happy with or without kids. But if Che wanted to be a mother, they'd find a way. So, in the early 1970s, they adopted a boy and a girl. Their happiness was complete.
Or so it seemed. As the South Korean government became more oppressive in the late 60s and early 70s, in the wake of North Korea's attacks and assassination attempts, Shin Song-ok began to get in trouble with the law.
Shin believed rules were for other people. He just wanted to make his films the way he saw fit. But his films didn't always adhere to the government's strict censorship laws, and he started to get hauled into court more and more regularly.
According to Elliot D. Cohen, Ph.D., the president of the Institute of Critical Thinking Center for Logic-Based Therapy, this rebellious reaction to an oppressive regime is not uncommon. Cohen cites Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels' Communist Manifesto for its prediction that openly oppressive systems produce rebellions, often violent ones.
When people are aware of their oppression, they become more likely to act out, especially as the regime grows more oppressive.
Simultaneously, even as he found himself getting in trouble with the government, Shin Song-ok started to run into financial troubles. For tax and regulation reasons, South Korean laws mandated studios make a minimum number of films per year. Shin Film found itself struggling to keep up as its director and producer stretched himself and his resources thinner and thinner, making more films on smaller budgets. Creditors started showing up with increasing frequency.
And then, in 1974, the tabloids caught Shin Song-ok having an affair with a younger actress. At first, Cheon-hee didn't want to believe it, but when she discovered that the young woman was pregnant with her husband's child, it was too much. In a move that shocked traditional Korean society, Cheon-hee kicked her husband out. In 1976, she demanded a divorce.
Up to that point, Shin Song-ok may not have realized just how much their business had been kept afloat by his wife, or how much his popular goodwill depended upon her.
Then, at the same time that his marriage was falling apart, he was charged with bribing a censor and ended up in prison. When he was released, he found himself on the verge of bankruptcy, dodging investors and creditors.
The final straw came when he screened a film that violated the government's ethics code. Instead of a usual slap on the wrist, the government revoked his studio's license to make films. And when Shin Song-ok sued, he found himself arrested and interrogated by the KCIA.
Meanwhile, Cheon-hee felt that her life was over. She'd lost her best friend and collaborator, and suddenly found herself on her own with two young children. Not only that, but she was fighting to keep her acting school and her own finances afloat. And at age 50, her own acting career was floundering.
Che was a survivor who'd picked herself up before, but she had never imagined she'd have to do it again at this point in her life. She found herself feeling the same stress that had driven her to leave her first husband, abandoning the life she had 20 years ago before Shin.
Reluctantly, she forced herself to move on once again. The couple went their separate ways and tried to salvage their careers without one another.
Shin Song-ok started to look for directing opportunities abroad, as he was barred from working in South Korea. The director traveled as much as he could, trying to develop films in Europe and the U.S.
But nothing seemed to be coming through. The industry abroad seemed to work so much slower than he was used to. If only he could find a collaborator willing to finance his movies.
Little did he know that just across the border, an eager financier was waiting for him.
By the mid-1970s, North Korea's supreme leader, Kim Il-sung, had made it clear that his eldest son, Kim Jong-il, would be his successor. The short, round man seemed nothing like his war hero father, but they shared a ruthlessness and a love of power.
By the time he was in his mid-30s, Jong-il had paved a way for himself by ensuring any rivals had met premature deaths or were sentenced to brutal work camps. He then started to divide his time between running the country and running his own movie studio. As he became the DPRK's de facto leader, he started to realize that his two interests dovetailed.
His outward-facing goal for North Korea was to improve its reputation around the globe and to show that it was better than South Korea in every possible way. The best way to achieve this, he reasoned, was through cinema, which he knew from personal experience could win hearts and minds.
But it didn't take long for Kim Jong-il to realize that North Korea's film industry lacked the kind of creative minds needed for good storytelling. two decades of executing or imprisoning anyone who spoke a word against the Kim family seemed to have stifled the country's artistic expression.
The solution to his problem seemed easy enough. If he couldn't find a satisfactory collaborator in North Korea, he would find one abroad. But since North Korea didn't really allow visitors, he decided to take a page out of the swashbuckling James Bond movies he loved so much and bring his collaborator to him.
By 1978, North Korea had a reputation for kidnapping people. They would snatch people from around the world and bring them to North Korea, often to work as language and culture teachers in spy schools. The majority of captives seem to have been Japanese or Japanese-born Koreans, but a number of European, Middle Eastern, and South Asian hostages were taken as well.
Often these kidnappings seemed to be random. A tour guide in Macau was taken while showing a businessman around the city. Four women who worked as escorts in Singapore were kidnapped upon arriving at a job on a yacht. Young couples picnicking on beaches in Japan were grabbed. Women introduced to wealthy Chinese businessmen woke up in North Korea. Most of the time, the people simply disappeared and were never heard from again.
Sometimes the kidnappings weren't successful. Most famously, in 1977, the South Korean pianist Paik Kang-woo and his wife were invited to perform for a wealthy businessman in Yugoslavia. But upon arrival in Zagreb, they became suspicious and went directly to the U.S. Embassy for help. It turned out that their instincts were right. The North Korean operatives had paid off the Zagreb police in a kidnapping attempt. Luckily for the couple, the Americans were able to help them escape.
Choi Eun-hee and Shin Song-ok, like all South Koreans, were aware of these kidnappings, but neither of them ever suspected they would be a target.
In a moment, a business trip turns into a nightmare.
Now, back to the story. Late in 1977, a Hong Kong businessman named Wang Dong-il showed up at Choi Eun-hee's acting academy. He told her that back in Hong Kong, he too ran a film studio with an attached acting academy. He admired Choi Eun-hee's work and asked if she might be interested in linking their two schools and running his as well. He invited her to Hong Kong for the film festival so she could stop by his facility. The 51-year-old actress was flattered, and she needed the money. But she couldn't take the time to go to Hong Kong and deferred the offer.
A few months later, Wang Dong-il sent her a script and asked if she might be interested in directing it for his studio. It had been years since Choi Eun-hee had directed a movie, and the money was good. Her interest was more than piqued.
She called her ex-husband and asked what he thought she should do. The two were still friendly, even as they had gone their separate ways. But Shin Song-ok scoffed. Hong Kong was a film industry hub, full of renowned talent. Why would a producer in Hong Kong want her to direct?
But Choi Eun-hee heard the jealousy in his voice. If she wasn't sold on the project already, Shin pushed her over the line.
On January 11, 1978, Wang Dong-il picked her up at the airport in Hong Kong. They spent the next 2 days exploring the city. Every time Choi Eun-hee wanted to talk business, the producer deflected.
On the third day, Wang Dong-il had to attend to unexpected business. Choi Eun-hee decided to drop by the Shin Film Office in Hong Kong, which Shin Song-ok had managed to keep open in the hopes he'd soon get another commission. As Choi Eun-hee caught up with a few longtime employees, the manager, a man named Kim Kyu-hwa, introduced her to a woman around her own age, an old friend of his.
A fellow South Korean, Lee Song-hee lived in Hong Kong. The two women hit it off, and Lee Song-hee offered to take Choi Eun-hee around town the next day while she waited for Wang Dong-il to finish his business. Happy to have a friend, Choi Eun-hee took her up on the offer.
When Choi Eun-hee met up with Lee Song-hee and her young daughter the next morning, January 14, 1978, her new friend was visibly excited, if a little on edge. As they explored the city, Lee Sung-hee talked about her wealthy business contacts, who'd surely love to meet the film star and might even be interested in investing in her school.
Jae-yun-hee was unsure whether or not the venture with Wang Dong-il would pan out, but agreed it would be good to meet them.
During lunch, Lee Sung-hee ran out to make a call. When she returned, she announced that one of her contacts was at his home in Hong Kong today. They could drive out to his house on the coast to visit with him before the actress's dinner plans. Still hoping to get a business deal out of the trip, Jae-yun-hee agreed.
Well, to the rest of us, Jae-yun-hee's good fortune might seem too good to be true, but a study by Anthony J. Porcelli and Mauricio R. Delgado of Rutgers University shows that people under stress are less able to utilize more rational and deliberative thinking to assist in making decisions. This is especially true when it comes to financial decisions.
In other words, when under stress, people are more likely to make riskier financial decisions and more likely to make choices that have a higher reward, but are far less likely to pan out, which is exactly what Jae-yun-hee did.
Around 4 o'clock that afternoon, their taxi drove along an empty road next to a quiet beach on the southern side of Hong Kong Island. Jae-yun-hee had no idea where they were, though she could see large houses lining the coastline.
Suddenly, Lee Sung-hee told the cabbie to stop and announced they were getting out.
Jae-yun-hee was a bit confused. It wasn't exactly beach weather, and it seemed weird to waste time at the beach when she had to be back in the city for dinner at 6 p.m.
She asked Lee Sung-hee if perhaps they should ask the taxi to wait. The other woman wasn't concerned and said they'd be able to call one easily.
Jae-yun-hee started to wonder what was going on. When she asked, Lee Sung-hee didn't answer and instead looked around expectantly as if waiting for someone.
Unsure of what to do, Che joined Lee Sung-hee's daughter in heading down towards the waves, watching the mist roll in off the winter sea.
Suddenly, Lee Sung-hee called out to them, "Come here!"
When Jae-yun-hee looked down the beach, she saw the other woman standing by a white speedboat. A handful of muscular, long-haired men were jumping off the speedboat around her. They were all watching Che.
Alarm bells started to go off in her head. Everything about this felt weird.
But Lee Sung-hee's daughter ran over to the boat, oblivious to any possible concerns. So Jae-yun-hee followed her.
As she approached them warily, Lee Sung-hee explained that the men had come to take them to her contact's villa, just 10 minutes away.
That seemed reasonable, but still, Jae-yun-hee felt something was wrong. She didn't like the way the men were looking at her.
Then the men rushed her. They grabbed her and threw her into the boat. Before she could even try to fight back, they were speeding off across the bay.
As the boat turned out of the bay towards the ocean, a panicked Jae-yun-hee looked at Lee Sung-hee, who calmly lit a cigarette and told her not to worry.
Dreading the answer, Che demanded to know where they were going. The answer made her heart stop. They were headed to North Korea. That was the last thing she remembered, and she passed out from shock. The next thing Jae-yun-hee saw was Kim Il-sung's smiling face.
When Che finally came to, she realized she was on a bed in the captain's cabin. Above her hung a huge portrait of the North Korean supreme leader.
And once she overcame the initial shock, she took stock of her surroundings.
She was no longer on the speedboat. She was on a cargo ship somewhere at sea.
One of the men from the speedboat watched her around the clock. A doctor and his wife took care of her, giving her medicine and trying to coax her to eat.
From the next cabin, she could hear Lee Sung-hee sobbing. Apparently, the woman hadn't realized she'd be kidnapped too.
Jae-yun-hee had no idea why the North Koreans, and Kim Il-sung in particular, had kidnapped her. Maybe when she was younger, he might have wanted her as a sex slave, but she was 51 now. She doubted that would still be the case. Either way, they'd clearly gone to a lot of trouble to get her there.
She remembered what Shin Song-ok had said when she told him about the directing opportunity. Maybe he had been jealous, but he had also been right to be wary. She should have listened.
She thought about her children, her students, her siblings, and her parents, all home in South Korea. What would they think had happened to her? That she'd run away and abandon them? The thought of that broke her heart.
4 days into their journey, she was allowed to go up on deck to get some fresh air. She stood against the railing and stared down into the churning ocean waters beneath them. She'd heard stories about the brutality of the North Korean regime and knew that whatever awaited her was worse than death.
She looked around. No one was paying attention to her.
Shaking, she started to climb up onto the ship's railing, summoning the courage to jump.
Meanwhile, people in Hong Kong were finally noticing that something was wrong. The hotel Che had been staying at called the police to complain that a guest had left without paying and had left all her stuff.
When the police showed up at her hotel room, they noticed that everything was left as if she'd been planning to come back. All her clothes, her makeup and skincare products, her personal effects. Something was amiss.
As the police got to work in Hong Kong, Shin Song-ok was back in South Korea and starting to worry about his ex-wife. He was in the process of applying for a visa to work in the U.S. and was planning to fly to Los Angeles within the next few days. But he was surprised that Cheon-hee hadn't returned home yet from what he'd thought would be a quick trip.
He called the head of his Hong Kong office, a longtime employee named Lee Young-seng. But Lee Young-seng told him they couldn't talk about it over the phone. He insisted that Shin Song-ok come to Hong Kong right away.
The next day, Shin flew to Hong Kong. Lee Young-seng and the manager, Kim Kyu-hwa, walked him through what they knew of Cheon-hee's last movements on the island. When they mentioned Kim Kyu-hwa's friend Lee Song-hee, an alarm went off in his brain.
Shin Song-ok remembered his conversations over the years with Lee Song-hee, as she'd often drop by the studio to visit. And he remembered her husband did lots of business in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital.
He took this tidbit to the Hong Kong police and tried to track down Lee Song-hee, but she had seemingly disappeared without a trace.
By January 27th, while Shin Song-ok searched Hong Kong, the news of the missing actress had hit newspapers. From the start, there were rumblings that her disappearance was motivated by political interests.
In February, the police searched Lee Song-hee's apartment. There, they found a used plane ticket to Pyongyang and a copy of one of Shin Song-ok's movie scripts. But instead of seeing this as support for North Korean involvement, they saw it as an indictment of Shin Song-ok.
Not only did the police begin tailing him, but rumors now swirled that he had his ex-wife killed or kidnapped for either revenge or financial reasons.
Well, Shin Song-ok tried to push back. He held a desperate press conference, insisting that the North Koreans were somehow behind her disappearance, begging people to take him seriously. But neither the Hong Kong police nor South Korean intelligence were convinced.
The Hong Kong police formally interrogated Shin Song-ok as a suspect, insinuating that he had planned the abduction with Lee Song-hee.
Shin Song-ok protested, saying he had no idea how the script had gotten into Lee Song-hee's apartment, but maybe her friend, his employee Kim Kyu-hwa, could give them more information. Kim Kyu-hwa was hauled into the interrogation. Under pressure, he finally admitted that Lee Song-hee had paid him to introduce her to Cheon-hee.
That admission alone was enough to clear Shin Song-ok of suspicion, though it wasn't the full truth. Later, the Hong Kong police arrested Kim Kyu-hwa and extradited him back to South Korea. There, under interrogation, he finally admitted that North Korean operatives had paid both him and the studio executive, Wang Dong-il, to get Cheon-hee to Hong Kong.
Shin Song-ok was bereft. He had no idea what the North Koreans had done with his ex-wife or why they'd gone to such lengths to abduct her.
And to make matters worse, he was running out of money. He still hadn't managed to find work abroad, and he only had a few months left on his passport. If it expired, he was sure the South Korean government wouldn't give him a new one. He'd be trapped in a country where he wasn't allowed to make movies. The two things Shin Song-ok had loved above all else, filmmaking and Choi Eun-hee, had been taken from him.
Shin Song-ok found himself back in Hong Kong in July 1978. The investigation into Choi Eun-hee's disappearance seemed to have stalled, and Shin Song-ok felt like he was the only one who still cared. At the Shin Film office in Hong Kong, he met with his employee, Lee Young-sang, to strategize.
Lee Young-sang floated one last desperate idea. He knew a guy, he said, who could get passports from a Central American country. Another passport would allow Shin to stay there and keep looking for Choi Eun-hee and possibly find work. It was pricey, $10,000, or about $39,000 today.
If it didn't work, Shin Song-ok would be forced to return to South Korea completely broke. But if it paid off, it could save him.
He'd been making movies so long that the line between reality and a good story had started to blur, and this plan was the stuff of box office hits. Shin Song-ok said yes.
When the arrangements had been made, the two men took the ferry to Hong Kong Island. Their contact sent a car to pick them up.
As the car wound its way around the island, Shin Song-ok barely paid attention to where they were going. He wondered about the consequences of getting the Central American passport. He might never be able to go home to South Korea again. He had resorted to the nuclear option. His entire life, his friends, family, children, he would never see them again.
As they drove around Repulse Bay, past an empty beach on the southern side of the island, four men jumped out in front of the car. The driver slammed on the brakes.
The men pulled Shin Song-ok out of the car, one of them pressing a knife into his throat. They demanded money.
Terrified, Shin Song-ok begged for his life and tried to give them the money in his pocket. But before he could, one of the other men put a bag over his head.
As he started to panic, they chloroformed him and he passed out.
When he next came to, he opened his eyes to the same smiling portrait of North Korean leader Kim Il-sung, beaming down at him.
Confused and scared, Shin Song-ok took stock of where he was. A cargo ship. A muscular man sat in the corner, keeping watch. Shin asked him about his ex-wife, and the man pursed his lips. She's dead.
Shin's ears rang. He refused to believe it, but as the cargo ship sailed through the choppy sea, he wondered if the same would happen to him. Either way, Shin knew he was about to go behind the curtain of a brutal dictatorship, a country many had been smuggled into, but few ever left alive.
Next week on Hostage, we'll find out what happened to Choi Eun-hee and Shin Song-ok during their captivity in North Korea, and take a look at the psychology of surviving a years-long hostage situation. We'll also delve into a daring escape attempt worthy of a James Bond film.
For more information on this story, amongst the many sources we used, we found A Kim Jong-il Production, The Extraordinary True Story of a Kidnapped Filmmaker, His Star Actress, and a Young Dictator's Rise to Power by Paul Fisher, extremely helpful to our research. Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows on Spotify or anywhere else you listen to podcasts.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Paul Libeskind, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Carly Madden. This episode of Hostage is written by Kate Thorman and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.